Support for this episode comes from NerdWallet. Got money goals? NerdWallet's got your back. Looking for a credit card with better cash back? NerdWallet's got tons of tools and tips to help you find the card you're looking for. Finally ready to buy your first home? NerdWallet has calculators to help you find a mortgage that works for you. And if you want your money to work as hard as you do, NerdWallet's got side-by-side comparisons to help you find the smartest investing account. Whatever your money goals may be, NerdWallet helps you compare and find the smartest financial products for you. NMLS 1617539.
Hi, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue in Conversation. My name is Brian Salvatore, and joining me on the show today is musician Chris Forsyth. Much like myself, Chris Forsyth hails from New Jersey originally, but now finds himself in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, though he has retained his Mets fandom at the expense of some of his other fandoms because of his current city. But Chris is a big Mets fan. He's also a fantastic guitar player and a really innovative songwriter. I would highly recommend for those that have not heard of Chris before to just throw his name into Spotify or Apple Music, whatever your music streaming device of choice is, and just take a listen. He is an incredibly natural and melodic guitar player. I love, love, love his most recent live record with Garcia Peoples. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about the Mets, about music, and more. So enjoy my conversation with Chris. All right, so, you know, I often tell people that my two earliest loves in life kind of came together, which was that I would watch baseball with my dad and I would listen to music in the car with my mom. So what was sort of like, what was your first entryway into both music and baseball?
Well, with baseball, I was fortunate growing up in New Jersey. The company that my father worked for, he was a salesman for a like truck body company, and the company had season tickets at Shea from, I mean, as early as I can remember, which I think probably the earliest consciousness I have is maybe like 78 or so. Mm-hmm. And so we went to games just all the time. It's just what my family did, you know. I mean, pack up a big cooler of iced tea and some sandwiches and go up there and see the games. My dad's a baseball maniac, and he sort of passed that on to me. As far as music goes, it's a little different. Both of my grandfathers actually were professional musicians, but also I think, I mean, you know, baseball is a tough business too, I suppose. But you know, music is not necessarily the most lucrative business for most people that are in it. And so I think my parents grew up as being like, "Oh, music, that's a very nice hobby." Like, and they facilitated me. You know, bought me guitar when I wanted one and stuff like that. But they were much more practical minded. I learned a lot about music from my older sister. I've got a sister who's like 18 months older than me. And, but you know, so she turned me on to a lot of things, but it was a slow gradual thing. It wasn't like I grew up in a musical culture or musical family. You know, I mean, technically, I guess where I come from is kind of Springsteen country, but by the time I was, you know, by the mid 80s, it was definitely more Bon Jovi culture than Springsteen culture also. And, you know, so I just grew up listening to classic rock on the radio and you know, there's good college radio stations around too that I got into as I got older.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like in Jersey, you can tell sort of like your generation of Jersey versus like who your friends thought was the cool artist. Like I definitely grew up, I was in high school in the late 90s. And so for me, there was a lot of like the sort of third, fourth wave of punk bands that were coming out of New Jersey were sort of the cool thing. I was like a big Ted Leo guy when I was in high school, you know, that was sort of my guy. But I have cousins that are slightly older than me, and they were into Bon Jovi. And then, you know, my mom was into Springsteen. So, you know, it's interesting to sort of see the like layers of Jersey cool music.
Peter Kirlin, the bass player who plays on nearly all the my records, he played with Ted Leo.
Oh, okay.
in the, I don't know if it was the late 90s, but no, yeah, I guess it would have been the late 90s. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's on one of the early records. I don't remember which.
Okay. Yeah. So what was your first band like?
The first band I had was called The Ordinary Boys. I think there is a band called that, or has been a band called that afterwards, but we were the
name.
First. It was, well, it was lifted from a Smiths or Morrissey lyric or something. And I mean, we were, I was talking about this with somebody else recently, because I have a 10-year-old, and I think that it seems like what music was for my generation, video games are for his, like, everything is wrapped up in that. Whereas when I was in high school, there was like, it was common for there to be bands in the high school. There was like a battle of the bands every year, and yep. every grade had a, you know, a few different bands. There was like the metal band. Remember, they were called Fatal Array. There was like kind of a proto alternative band. There was like the band made up of the kids who could really play well, who were like in the jazz band and did like Rush songs and stuff. And the band I had was, our big thing was that we wrote our own songs, partly because we couldn't play too many other songs, but which, well, I mean, we were picking up on the kind of punk thing, and we're all completely self-taught. So, you know, it was, somewhat out of necessity. But that was the thing that set us apart. I mean, we did covers too. We did a lot of like REM songs and Stones and, other kinds of, also like kind of alternative rock of the day and mixed in with some classic rock stuff. But we always, like at the Battle of the Bands, we always did like, you know, three original songs and two covers or something like that. Whereas the other bands were all strictly covers, although not the metal band. The metal band had their own songs too. Yeah.
I remember taking great pride in my, I think it was my sophomore or junior year, that my band was the only band at the talent show that year who did an original song. So
yeah,
I definitely understand the thing. And again, it was just easier than learning somebody else's song in a lot of ways. And so when you got into music, you know, in high school in that time, did your baseball fandom fall off? Because for me, there's like this period of time when I was, when playing guitar was all I wanted to do, and I guess I still, if I was offered a ticket to a game, I'd go, but it wasn't like something, I wasn't poring over the box scores every morning. I wasn't watching highlights or whatever. But did your baseball fandom dip in that point, or were you always kind of into it?
I think the thing that caused it to dip, actually, which, and this is kind of a bummer, is that, because I also played baseball, and when I got into high school, there was a coach who was like, I mean, this guy would not have a job today, I would like to think, based on the way that he, you know, acted and talked to people. But he basically bullied me off the team because I, you know, had like slightly long hair and played the guitar.
Wow.
Here's a funny, I mean, in retrospect, it's a funny anecdote, but I had bought tickets to go to see REM. This must have been 1988. The show, I think, was at Brendan Byrne Arena. I mean, it was an arena show.
Right.
But in my high school, you know, there was like maybe 6 kids or 10 kids that even had ever heard of REM. So it's just cultural. It's also like a weird thing about how a band could be that big. And also in my sort of provincial town, just completely unknown.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I had bought tickets to go see REM, and you had to, you know, buy the tickets in like January, and the show was in April or May. And there was an away game on the day of the concert. And I said to my parents, like, oh, there's this problem. They sent in a note to the coach that said, you know, we'd like to ask for permission for Chris to leave the away game with us, where the regulation was that you had to go back on the school to school, right? And Chris can leave the game with us because he's going to a concert in New York. And they said yes. And then as the season went on, and like practices went on, and the coach started giving me more and more of a hard time, it came out that it was not like, I guess they thought it was some kind of like symphony event or some kind of family concert thing, you know, and some kind of a sanctioned cultural event. They're like, a rock concert. And I got called down to the athletic director's office, and the coach was in there, and they were leaning over me and giving me a hard time for not being a team player. And the coach said, what is this concert you're going to anyway? And I said, it's a rock concert. And he said, what, who is it? What is this rock concert? And I said, REM. And he said, REO Speedwagon. And I was just like, no, like, and anyway, my parents stood up for me and
good for them.
You know, yeah. And they let me go to the, you know, they were like, no, he's going to the concert. Like, you know, don't be, you know, my parents were not wildly liberal, you know, type people at all, but they just identified that these guys were being unfair and kind of bullying. So there was some of that. I mean, I got basically driven off the team after my sophomore year. And, yeah, I didn't want to stop playing. I was into it, but I was getting such a hard time about it. I never thought about it this way until many years later. I was telling this to a therapist, and they're like, "Well, you were bullied," and I was like, "Oh yeah, I guess I was." Like, I didn't even identify it as that. I just thought the guy was a jerk. But
yeah,
you know. Anyway, but that, you know, that was also so long ago, and that coach was full of all kinds of other negative, you know, things that he said that I just think wouldn't fly these days. But it's so that's a different era, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Just like in Major League Baseball, it was a different era. I mean, this was the era of like the late 80s Mets, you know, so.
Right.
A lot of that wouldn't fly today either.
No, it wouldn't.
Support for this episode comes from Locker Room, the app that's changing the way we talk sports. Locker Room is a sports fan's dream come true. It's a live audio platform that lets you connect with other fans, experts, and even the athletes themselves. Locker Room makes it easy to start your own conversations. Talk about the latest rumors, takes, news, and teams you care about most. Join massive watch parties for all of your friends to react together in real time as you celebrate a buzzer beater or suffer the agony of a crucial bricked free throw. And if you've got a bunch of supremely spicy takes you'd like to fire off, you're in luck. You can even record the conversations if you want and release them as a podcast. So it's time to start thinking about catchy titles. It's all totally free and available at the iOS App Store right now. So go download it today. Locker Room, changing the way we talk sports.
Got money goals? NerdWallet's got your back with the smartest credit cards, mortgages, investing accounts, and more. Maybe you're looking to book that thrice postponed honeymoon. NerdWallet can help you compare and find the smartest travel rewards card now so you can earn points towards that much-deserved trip. Or if you're thinking it's time for a bigger house now that your family is about to grow by exactly one bedroom, NerdWallet's got calculators and tools to help you find the smartest mortgage. And since your family is growing, it's probably a good idea to think about your child's future college plans, right? Well, NerdWallet's got your back with the smartest investing accounts for college funds and more. With side-by-side comparison tools, calculators, and more, NerdWallet can help you find answers to all of your money goals, big or small. From credit cards, mortgages, investing accounts, and more, NerdWallet can help you compare and find the smartest financial products for you. For all of your money questions, turn to the nerds at NerdWallet. NMLS 1617539.
We emailed about this briefly, but so who are some of the Mets players that were like your favorites growing up? You know, guys that you really rooted for?
Oh, I mean, Keith Hernandez, Dwight Gooden, Gary Carter. I liked Hernandez the most because he was such a hard player and so great at defense and did all these like little things that don't show up in the stats. I always thought, you know, he was my favorite on that team. But I mean, all those guys, that was my team, you know?
Yeah, I was 4 in 86, so yeah. I don't have – I mean, I have memories of sort of the dwindling of that team, you know, of people being there at the end and then people being traded away and all of that. For me, what was a lot of fun as a Mets fan was I always felt like the Mets played a lot of day games back in that time on the Sports Channel. Remember the Sports Channel that was
sure.
I think it was Channel 3 in my local cable package. But I remember coming home from school and being able to watch the Mets games and – really identifying with even then, because even, you know, I'm probably talking 88, 89 at this point, and those Mets teams weren't bad. Like, they were pretty good, but they still felt like the underdogs in a way.
Yeah.
And I've always kind of identified with that underdog spirit, and I feel like there's no city in the world where there is such a clear baseball choice between the Mets and the Yankees. Like, I don't know, you know, I'm not somebody who hates the Yankees, like, on you know, for no reason. But I feel like when you talk to Yankee fans, they have a totally different view of baseball than Mets fans do.
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Definitely. I mean, I'm always surprised when I, I'm really good friends with somebody, and they turn out to be a Yankees fan.
Well, I recently, about 4 or 5 years ago, I was at a show that Steve Wynn was playing.
Yeah.
And Steve Wynn was like, we were talking. Like,
he's a friend of mine, and he's a good example. He's a Yankees fan.
Yeah, and he was like, I live in Queens. I'm like, oh, you must be a Mets fan then. It was a Baseball Project show. And he's like, oh, no, I'm a Yankees fan. And my heart sank. I was like, come on, man. You're not even from here. You don't even have the, like, you don't have the family connection to it or something like that.
I've gone to a Mets game with him, though. I mean, he's, you know, he pulls for whoever. He'll root for the Mets, but the Yankees are his home team, definitely. Yeah. Maybe the Dodgers, I think, going back longer, you know, for him. But you know, about the games on TV, I have a very strong recollection of, I guess it was game 6 of the NLCS in 86, that like 18-inning game against the Astros. Mm-hmm. So I was in middle school. I think I was in 7th grade. And I was playing I was on the basketball team. And I remember I was like disappointed because I had a basketball practice that day, and I was like, I'm going to miss the game because the game was on at like 1:30 or something, or 2 o'clock. And I got home from school or from practice at like 5:30 or 6 or something like that. And it was like the 9th inning. And then I got I watched the game until, you know, 9:30 at night or whatever it went on till, like epic slugfest.
My dad used to trick me all the time because they also rebroadcast the game a lot. Come home from work and be like, I bet you $1 Strawberry hits a home run. And I'd be like, I'll take that bet. And then he had heard it on the radio the day before, whatever it was. So he would never actually take my money, but he would always mess with me with that. So let's talk about sort of when you went from music as a hobby to music as a career. What was the first big moment that you felt in your career that it was like, all right, well, this is setting me on the path now. This is what I'm going to do for, you know, the rest of my life.
Well, I mean, I think I knew from a young age that I was going to try to build my life around music. I mean, it was, you know, it still is like just a thing that it's not just a career or a hobby. It's like, you know, a passion and like an outlet, and and it's something that, you know, grounds me. So I think from a young age, I knew that. But again, like I didn't know any musicians, like professional musicians growing up. And that idea of that was not something that was really accessible to me. So I went to college, and I mean, I got out of college in 4 years, which for a lot of my friends was an accomplishment. but I was really, you know, playing in bands on the side the whole time. And then I moved to New York and continued playing music, but very much a long and winding road. I mean, I was involved in the very late 90s. I took lessons from Richard Lloyd, the guitar player in Television.
Oh, wow.
And he kind of taught me how to play, really. I had been playing for like, you know, 10, 12 years at that point, but totally self-taught. And I had all kinds of bad habits, and I had really no idea what I was doing in terms of like the mechanics or grammar of music, you know, music theory. So he, you know, I credit him with really teaching me how music works. And so from that point, it was another maybe 10 years of really practicing that stuff. And I continued to play in groups and kind of more on the experimental music side of things through the aughts. And then when I moved to Philly, really is when I started, I was starting to make music that people were responding to in a stronger way. And that was probably it, because, you know, anybody can make music, but it's that completion of like having an audience that gives you feedback and, you know, kind of completes the creative act, that somebody hears it. And then it was relatively recently, I mean, all things considered, like in the last 10, 12 years, that I started to get actually offered gigs and unsolicited attention and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So I was trying to describe your music to a friend of mine the other night, and I was failing miserably. How would you, because I feel like there's a lot of interesting elements to your music that when you try and put them together in words, it doesn't really flow for me. How would you describe what you do?
Well, I don't have like a pithy little genre name for it, although I probably should if I was, you know, really smart about it. But the way that I think about it is, again, I come from like this rock background. I also kind of diverged into this sort of experimental music world where, you know, in rock music, it's about the song and the singer, And, you know, also like the timbre of the instruments, like in rock music, the sound is as important or more important than the notes. But then in this kind of improvised music and experimental music world that I was swimming around in, like the chords and the lyrics were all not there anymore. It was this more sort of really about getting into flow and texture and stuff. And, but that, you know, it was sometimes that music wasn't that fun to listen to, I think, or it was very challenging to listen to. And, you know, once I was able to process that stuff that Richard taught me, I feel like I was able to kind of combine my more, you know, rooted, like lyrical rock, sensibility with this kind of more stretched out, elongated flow. And I think about it, there's two comparisons. One is, you know, I think about it maybe in relation to jazz. I don't play jazz. I'm not a jazz guitar player at all, although I listen to a lot of it. But that idea of like flow and themes and improvisation is big for me. And then also, you know, the guitar player John Fahey?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so Fahey, I think, you know, I mean, he's an incredible figure, and I think, you know, he's credited as sort of spawning this whole genre of, you know, quote, American primitive guitar playing. But, I think about what I'm trying to do as sort of similar conceptually as to what he did, because even though I don't think I really sound like what he does, but, you know, he was a guy who, you know, took blues music, combined it with these other kind of weird influences, erased the vocals. Like, there was no instrumental blues musicians before John Fahey that I'm aware of.
Right.
And, you know, kind of stretched it out and put his own weird spin on it. And I think about that as being kind of what I do with rock music. Like, I take this music that I really do know how to play and sort of try to combine, graft other kind of influences onto it. You know, my music is mostly instrumental. There's vocals on some of them, but, you know, it's largely this kind of, you know, cinematic kind of instrumental thing.
Yeah, I had first heard your stuff from a friend of mine who had been playing me like some Riley Walker stuff and, you know, some people that I think if I were younger and more ignorant, I would probably say like indie rock meets the Grateful Dead. But I don't think that's really a super like eloquent way to put it. But just this idea of sort of stretching things out and jamming and sort of seeing where things go and following this improvisational muse, you know.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a term that's been sort of bandied around, I've heard, called like indie jam.
Right.
Which, I mean, you know, I've said this to people before too. It's like, I'm fine with it. Like, if it's a meaningless term to me, but if somebody if that brings somebody in or if that piques someone's interest, like, that's fine. I mean, I'm a huge Jerry Garcia fan, mm-hmm. and you know, as well as Sonic Youth or
right.
you know, whatever these other kinds of stuff that I was, you know, kind of that was turning my head on when I was really learning how to play back in the, you know, late 80s or 90s. But so yeah, I mean, that's not an unfair term, I don't think, but it's kind of like a real estate term. It's like, you know, neighborhoods change based on right, the time right, and whatever. Right. It's like, I mean, you know, and I think that most musicians probably don't. I mean, my relationship with the music is so sort of ineffable, and I think that it's true like that for a lot of musicians that, you know, we need people like labels or managers or journalists to be like to translate it for
sure.
You know,
sure.
Average, you know, listener or whatever.
I also think that for people of my generation and older, being a fan of like a quote a jam band meant something that I think people reduced down to a stereotype. Whereas now I think there's no shame in being like, no, I'm into punk and I also really like, you know, the Dead or Fish or whatever. But like when I was growing up, if you were into the Dead, that meant a very specific set of things that I don't think, that I think I still somewhat struggle with, even though I've played in a Dead cover band now and like I have a much deeper appreciation for a lot of their music. It's hard to like let go of what the 90s did to me in terms of being into jam bands was, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, back back then in the 80s and 90s, everything was more segregated and sort of, you know, people were in their lanes. And if you were into this, you weren't into that. You know, I remember going to see, I went to see Nirvana in September of 91 at City Gardens, which is a little club in Trenton. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had seen them before and, you know, was into them. I think my sister was in like the Sub Pop singles club where they would send you a different 7-inch every month. And so, you know, this was all, you know, we were into this kind of punk world. And I remember going to that show with my friend Dave and being looking around and being like, dude, what's with all the guys in Metallica and Megadeth t-shirts? Like, what are they doing here?
Right.
This is a punk show, not a metal show. But that's like, that's what Nirvana did. They were like, metalheads, come over here. Punk people, come over here. Now, meet.
You know? Right.
And there's a huge audience. So, and I was not a Grateful Dead fan when they were around. I just didn't get around to it. I don't know. But part of it, I certainly was the cultural divide, where if I was into X, there was this weird feeling of not being able to be into Y, and that's just gone now. I mean, that's just flattened. I think the internet kind of leveled that.
Yeah, yeah. I had heard somebody recently talk about that stuff where, like, when you're a kid, you were exposed to a certain sector of music based on radio and MTV or whatever, like, whatever your generational touchstones were, they were the gatekeepers for you. But with the internet, it's just as easy to be into records from the 20s as like the 2020s as the 1920s, right? You can go on Spotify and find anything. And so there's much less of a sort of dogmatic approach to scenes and, you know, genres. And I think that's ultimately a good thing. But I often say I'm happy I grew up in the generation that had to hunt.
Like
I'm really glad I had to go to the record store and prepay for a record I read about in a magazine article and wait 2 weeks.
Or when it was hard to find a Stooges record.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I mean, I think on balance it's good. I mean, down with the barriers. I mean, I think that's great. Like, people shouldn't have those kinds of hang-ups. I think that when I also see this thing, like I said, with my son where he's getting really into video games, and it seems like that is filling the kind of, like, from when I was a kid, music and which music culture you sort of subscribed to or self-identified with was a big part of who you were and how you saw yourself and where you were in the world. And like, if you're into punk, you know, you probably felt a little bit alienated or not, you know, like, and, you know, didn't want to go and see Def Leppard or something, even though I had the first few Def Leppard records for sure when I was a kid.
Right.
But, you know, I think that kind of thing just doesn't seem to exist anymore. Like, culture has just kind of gotten flattened and everything has equal value. And, you know, I think that, again, on balance, I think that's good, although it also presents other kinds of challenges, too.
Certainly. Now, speaking of those other challenges, how have you been doing with the pandemic the last year? You know, for musicians, live gigs are the lifeblood of your income and what you do every day. So how have you been adapting through the pandemic?
You know, again, I'm sort of like, I've had such a oddly paced and shaped music life or career that, like, I, for example, am not somebody that was wholly dependent on live gigs. I think in 2019, I did 19 shows. I'm not somebody that wants to go out on the road for 6 or 8 months at a time, for a lot of reasons, but, you know, for my own mental and physical health, I have a family. I like traveling, but, you know, there's a lot of dangers and bad stuff out there on the road too.
Yeah.
I've been putting out records and doing my, you know, week or 2 week tours here and there. And that was going just fine. But I had planned to put out, a live album, before the pandemic. I mean, I planned this back in the fall of 19 and, did a gig here in Philly at a venue called Johnny Brenda's. And I had been doing some shows with, this other band, Garcia Peoples, who are from New Jersey / New York. And they, as sort of my backing band, along with, I mean, the members of the band that I, bands that I'm using are always sort of rotating, but this drummer Ryan Jewell was also on hand, and bass player Peter Curlin, who I mentioned before. And then the rest of the guys were from Garcia Peoples. So we multi-tracked this show, and because when I play, there's a lot of improvisation and the music changes, and depending who I'm playing with, it changes. And so this is what I mean by the kind of jazz notion where it's the singer, not the song. It's who's playing it, not what the song is right. that really kind of brings it alive. And so I wanted to, share that or document that. And I had played the recording for No Quarter, the label that I primarily work with on the studio stuff. And he was like, this is great, but I don't think I can really put it out. Like, people don't really buy live albums and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay, I'll do it myself. And I decided that I would just put it up on Bandcamp and see what happened and finance it myself. And then that turned out, the record came out on March 20th. And that the date had been predetermined also months before, but it turned out to be the first Bandcamp Friday.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, right when the pandemic was like, the roof was caving in on people. And I had the biggest tour that I was, that I would have done in my life actually planned at that time. I was supposed to go out west and open for White Denim for like 18 shows or 15 shows or something like that. You know, in pretty big rooms for me, like 500, 750 capacity rooms. And, that got canceled, of course, but the record sold out on the day it was released.
Oh, wow.
So, and then Bandcamp, you know, who have really stepped up and I think done a great job, supporting musicians more than any other tech platform. Which is because I think the thing is that Bandcamp actually is a company that's based around music, not just technology like right. Spotify or data. So, I just kept on rolling with the Bandcamp stuff, and now I have my own record label. I was just before this interview, I was emailing about another release that I'm going to be putting out, in a few months, and I have another one at the plant that I have to go pick up tomorrow. So,
wow.
I actually, something that was absolutely not planned, it was sort of accidental, but it ended up sort of happening at the right time. So 2020 obviously was full of all kinds of challenges, but, musically I've been in some ways more productive than ever, even though I only played music with other people once in the entire year.
Wow.
Which was the first time, you know, that's the longest I'd gone without playing music with people probably since I was like 13.
Yeah.
So that sucked, but you know, on the bright side though, I feel like I managed to reach a lot of new people, and it's been very gratifying to have these records coming out. And, you know, I'm doing it kind of cottage industry style. Like I press up 1,000, and, there's a distributor in the UK that has been selling them for me over there. And the rest of them I do direct. So I'm literally slapping the label on the box and, you know, seeing the people that it's going to and, you know, repeat customers and being in touch with people. And it's actually been really great.
Do you see that as being the way forward for the long haul now, or do you think that you want to go back to being, you know, on a label, sort of letting somebody else manage that, or do you feel like, no, this is good for you for the long haul now?
I think I'm going to do both. I mean, I'm planning another studio record with No Quarter, and the label I'm doing is super fun and gratifying and profitable even, but the side of the music business that I have not just antipathy about, I kind of don't like, is the whole sort of public relations, PR,
yep.
Media, press kind of booking agent cabal bullshit. And so with the Bandcamp thing, I don't have to do that at all. So I'm able to like reach people directly through a mailing list or through Bandcamp messaging, and that's been really good, and it's satisfying and it's cool. But I'm putting out these kind of I fortunately had a bunch of very well recorded multi-track live shows that were pretty diverse and all over the map, and I've been kind of putting those out, and it's been developing into some other ideas. But the next studio record I'm going to do with No Quarter, because Mike does press, and Mike can like reach more people than
sure,
I can.
Sure.
But you know, he's got skills and legs to work in an area that I just don't want to deal with. Right. So I think it's fine to do both. You know, I mean, you could think of this as like the fan club stuff, and you know, Mike is the label putting out the, sure, the bigger stuff or whatever. So I think they can feed into each other. You know, I mean, and talking about the Dead, it's funny. I have that book, Everything I Learned About Business, I Learned from the Grateful Dead. And a lot of this stuff is sort of the things that they were pioneering in the 70s, you know, like direct contact with the fans and mm-hmm. selling things direct and sort of being their own independent entity that did all of this stuff themselves, did not really interface with the, you know, conventional ways of doing business in the music industry at the time. And I mean, obviously on a much larger scale than I am, but you know, there's some inspiration there too.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as long as you can keep the payroll under like 50 people or whatever it was that they had to pay, you know, to keep going, you'll probably, those are good lessons. I mean, when you look at the bands that are most successful now, and I'm not saying artists, cause I know you know, you can't compare like the average DIY band with, you know, a huge artist on a major label, but the bands that I'm going to see that are thriving really do have a personal relationship with their audiences. There's good communication there. And so sort of the barriers have fallen down a bit around all of this. So
yeah.
That's
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another one of those things. I mean, you know, as somebody who was into punk in the growing up and then not into the Dead because of some sort of perceived, you know, convention about it. You know, you get older and you realize like, oh, they were the punkest dudes ever, actually.
Right.
You know, they were the most independent. Oh, OK. So
now let's bring it back to baseball before I let you go here. Who are some of the current Mets that you're particularly jazzed about as the season starts in just a few hours from when we're talking?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, DeGrom is like head and shoulders above everybody. I'm excited to watch Lindor play. I have actually not spent I haven't spent any time actually watching spring training stuff. I read about it in the online and stuff, but I haven't actually seen him play a game yet. So I'm excited to see Lindor. I've been kind of in a deep Sixers hole lately. So I moved from New York to Philly, and like I've shed my New York sports fandom except the Mets. Like I can't let that one go, which is kind of risky in Philly. But
yeah, I'd say so.
But I've been on a deep Sixers bender this spring. So I haven't really focused too much on spring training, but you know, I mean, DeGrom is, I mean, you know, he's unbelievable. He's as good as anything gets. You know, he's as good as what he does as anybody can be as good at anything that they do.
Yes, yeah, it's pretty crazy when you sit back and you look at like the last 3 years of his performance, and you just say, okay, here's a guy who is entering the part of his career when velocity usually starts to dip, and his velocity
is going up.
It's going up, right? and usually you see them just start to, I don't want to say get lazy, but pitchers tend to form habits, right? And you tend to be a more predictable pitcher. He's less predictable now than he's ever been before. He's throwing harder. It's just fantastic.
I'm not comparing my level of talent to him at all, but I can relate to the fact that he kind of got a late start. You know,
yes,
he came into the league late. And took a couple years to ramp up. And I mean, even though obviously he's accomplished a lot, the two Cy Youngs and everything, but, you know, I think there's a lot of things that he's still super hungry for. Whereas if he had come up when he was 20 or 21 mm-hmm. and won his two Cy Youngs when he was 24 or 26, he might be in a different headspace than he is now. But yeah, he clearly is still like, you know, he wants to get back to the World Series, and he wants to win the Cy Young every year.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. And by the way, you're in for a treat watching Lindor. I mean, we all are. We are going to be so happy to watch that guy play every day. It's going to be
fantastic.
I mean,
it's the first time the Mets have had, like, a first-class shortstop in the history of the organization, right? I mean, am I right?
I would say he's instantly the best shortstop they've ever had. Yeah.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and
that's what I mean.
Yeah,
I'm not dissing Rafael Santana or
no,
whoever, but
there's never been as complete a player as Lindor playing shortstop. Certainly not, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And just I feel
I
like...
love a gold glove, man. I love a gold glove. I mean, that goes back to the Hernandez thing. I think when I was a kid, like, just love a gold glove.
Well, not only that, he has he has swagger, like, to spare, and he seems like a legitimately good person. Because I feel like sometimes those two things don't go together, right? The guy who's got the swagger can be a real dick, and he seems like a legitimately good guy who has swagger, and that's just so fun.
He's no Manny Ramirez.
No, exactly. and, you know, it's just, it's going to be, I think that last year's team was so disappointing because we all saw, like, we have a collection of all-time good guys on this team now. Like, Dom Smith seems like the best, you know. All these guys seem like these good people. And I hate to bring it down to that because, you know, I listened to lots of music and watched films by lots of people who probably are assholes, and that's okay, right? But it's fun when you can really root for the guys, not just because of the laundry they're wearing, but because they seem like good dudes. And so I think you add Lindor to that, and this is like an all-time fun team.
Yeah, I
can't wait to dig in.
Yeah, I'm stoked for sure.
Well, Chris, if folks want to find out more about your music, where would you direct them?
My Bandcamp page would be the number one spot. There's other links there that, you know, I have a website, thechrisforsythe.com. But, you know, if you just search for Chris Forsythe on Bandcamp, that's where you can find all the music. You can listen to all the music. You can buy all the music and, you know, and stay in touch. Like, if you follow me there, like, I can, you know, we can send, well, we can't send individual messages, but, you know, you'll get a heads up every time something happens.
Well, folks, thank you for listening to another Amazing Avenue in Conversation. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for lots more Mets content. We have game recaps, news, analysis, lots, lots more. Check it out. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can find this show on Spotify, on Stitcher, on Apple Podcasts. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Please rate, review, and subscribe. That helps other people find out about this show. Please check out the other Amazing Avenue audio shows, A Pod of Their Own, Amazing Avenue Audio, The Show, Unformatable, and From Complex to Queens. You can find me on Twitter at Brian Needs an App. Please check out Chris Forsythe's music. Again, he recommends you go to his Bandcamp page. It's a great place to start. And until next time, let's go Mets.